The 4th of July is coming. Are you looking for a good read? Well, our literary critic Steve Almond recommends Elizabeth Gilbert's The Signature of All Things, and the book was released in paperback last week. A good thing, because this is a big book. It's also a beautiful, intensely researched one that spans 18th and 19th century science and takes us from London to Peru, from Philadelphia to Tahiti. We meet sailors, botanists who travel with them to find life-saving plants. We meet abolitionists and spiritual all intersecting as ideas about science, religion, race, and class collide. At the center of the novel, the Whitaker family of Pennsylvania. Patriarch Henry scrounges his way from thief to deckhand and then amasses a fortune importing and selling botanicals, particularly quinine used to treat malaria. His daughter Alma, born in 1800, develops her own scientific passion when she looks at moss through a magnifying glass.
Now the miniature forest below her gaze sprang into majestic detail. She felt her breath catch. This was a stupefying kingdom. This was the Amazon jungle as seen from the back of a harpy eagle. She rode her eye above the surprising landscape, following its paths in every direction. Here were rich, abundant valleys filled with tiny trees of braided mermaid hair and minuscule tangled vines. Here were barely visible tributaries running through that jungle. And here was a miniature ocean in a depression in the center of the boulder, where all the water pooled.
Elizabeth Gilbert reading from The Signature of All Things, which marked her return to fiction after the monster success of her memoir, Eat, Pray, Love. We spoke to Elizabeth Gilbert about the novel when it was first published.
It started because I decided I wanted to write as a form of celebration. I wanted to write the biggest and most sweeping novel that I could. So it started with that dream. And I had recently become a gardener, so I knew that whatever I was going to write next had to be about plants or else it wouldn't hold my own attention. And then I came upon this copy of Captain Cook's Voyages from 1784 that had belonged to my great-grandfather. And I started reading it and discovered this idea of botanical exploration, that there was this moment between the end of the Age of Enlightenment and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution that was really the action adventure of the botany world. And it was so fascinating and so rich that I decided to set the novel there.
This is a time when ships went around the world, hundreds of plants were discovered, botanists taking the sailing risks right alongside the sailors.
Yeah. People were making their name and their fame at it. They were undercutting each other. They were selling out their countries. It was a really exciting time.
Well, and Henry is at the center of it, your character. We first meet him. He's the son of an orchardman in England's famed Kew Gardens. You describe it as a botanical Noah's Ark because of the thousands of specimens that are there. He steals some of them, but rather than being sent to prison, he's sent to sea. And there we go into that world where he's collecting plants. And he makes his fortune and arrives in Philadelphia because of quinine. The whole time I'm reading, I'm thinking, I wonder if there really was someone who made their fortune and settled in Philadelphia selling quinine. Was there?
Not really, but it's plausible. I spoke to a lot of botanical historians and laid out my theory for how Henry could have risen in the world and become the first millionaire in Philadelphia in the pharmaceutical trade. And quinine did seem to be a plausible way that he could have done it. And I thought there was something very exciting about sending a young, uneducated British boy down to Peru to break the Spanish monopoly on the quinine trade. Mm-hmm. So the quinine trade was certainly happening in that world, but there was no one figure quite like him.
As opposed to Alma, his daughter, who it seems is based on the 20th century moss researcher Dr. Robin Wall Kimmerer. You thank her in your acknowledgments.
She's based on a lot of people. Alma's sort of an amalgam of female botanists over the last three centuries, really. Dr. Robin Wall Kimmerer, she's my moss godmother, who guided me in this book and reassured me that the science was correct and that I was on the right track. She's only the most recent. Alma is also sort of modeled loosely on a number of what we're called polite botanists, which is what female botanists were called back in the day, to distinguish them from botanists, which were men. The work was exactly the same, but the men were threatened by their existence, and so they gave them this name of polite botanists, as if it were just a hobby. But there were a lot of them. Botany was the only science that was really open to women. They sort of snuck into that science through the garden gate and made some remarkable contributions.
Tell us more about this woman in particular, Alma, not at all attractive, in fact, thought of as ugly in some corners, but she discovers some writing about sexuality. And we know these books existed. So, by the way, did you research them?
That was probably the most fun research that I had to do was reading about Enlightenment-era pornography and pre-Victorian pornography, which was rampant, and there's still some wonderful examples of it. And I had a ball inventing the book that she discovers. Alma is put in charge of her parents' incredible library. Her father is not a great reader, but he collects books in an almost talismanic way, and she comes upon some very naughty writing. And it stirs in her a lust and a sort of exploration of her own body that ends up being a theme in her life for the rest of her life. And I knew from the beginning I wanted to write a female character who was very carnal and very sensual, but I didn't want that to be telegraphed in her looks. You know how in most novels the sexual woman always sort of looks like Jessica Rabbit? You know, like she always has like heaving breasts and flashing eyes and dangerous beauty. But we know that that's not really the reality, that sexuality is a locked door that can show up in any form, you know, and I wanted to unleash it in a woman who the world did not see as beautiful.
Well, and you give the Jessica Rabbit body and beautiful face to Alma's sister, who becomes a very serious abolitionist. And also into Alma's life, you bring Ambrose. Just very briefly, this is the man who, it's a thin line between whether he's mentally ill or so taken with the spiritualist movement of the time that he thought he could actually become an angel on earth. Is that true, that there were those people?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the people who are very mystical now and then, you know, they are kind of visitors here. You know, they do sort of have one foot elsewhere, and that's what makes them so attractive and appealing, but also makes them fragile and dangerous. And I've known people like that, and they're very attractive. And Alma does the thing that we do the first time we meet somebody like that. She fell in love with him.
Right.
You know, and the results were, well, I don't want to give away anything, but the results were interesting.
Well, and we've only gotten through maybe a quarter of the book, and we don't want to give away what happens when everyone packs off for Tahiti. You know, just amazing trail you take us on. How long were you immersed in this world, and how hard was it to kind of come up out of it?
It wasn't fun to come up out of it because I loved being in it so much. And I spent about 3.5 years doing research for this book. And for that, I have only Eat, Pray, Love to thank, because it financed this book. And I knew that I was in this very rare position that very few writers get to be in, and glancingly few women writers ever get to be in, which is somebody who can choose her own projects and fund her own projects.
Oh, it's just occurring to me, like Alma in some ways couldn't. You know, in other words, yeah, you had the freedom. She had a lot more freedom than a lot of women in that day, but you have even more.
Yeah, and I was aware of that as I was writing her story, but I was also aware of the ages of women writers who weren't able to, as I was able to, jump on a plane and go to Tahiti for 3 weeks and talk to people who are experts in missionary life there. And, you know, the sorts of freedoms that my position has now afforded me. And I felt like the only way to honor that was to write the kind of book that men have always written. You know, like write the big, rolling, sweeping epic, the big novel of ideas and a big novel of the world. That's the only way to honor how lucky I am to be where I am right now.
That's Elizabeth Gilbert. Her big novel of 19th century botany exploration and so much more is called The Signature of All Things. Elizabeth Gilbert, thanks so much for talking to us.
My very great pleasure. Thanks for having me, Robin.
And for more summer reading suggestions, go to hereandnow.org. We're starting a list there. And Jeremy, we're going to have another of my candidates tomorrow. We're going to be talking to Smith Henderson about his new 4th of July Creek. If this isn't on everyone's list of the best of summer, I will be dipped in shellac.
I'm reading American Catch, by the way, and Paul Greenberg, the author of that, is going to be on Fresh Air today. So there you go.
Well, there
it's
you
all
go.
On public radio. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.